Well, I want to apologize first for not actually being a perennial rice researcher. I don't work on perennial rice, and I can't claim any of the credit for any of the work that's going to be shown here. The real person who deserves that credit is Dr. Hengyi Hu at the Yunnan Academy of Agricultural Sciences. But unfortunately, he wasn't able to attend. He had expected to be able to come, and so he was on the program. Something came up, and he wasn't able to attend. And so I agreed to show his presentation because I thought I was going to be seeing him last week, because that was part of the problem. He had agreed to come to an event that we had organized. And then he couldn't make it to that one either. So he sent me his PowerPoint, but I didn't have the chance to really go over it with him. But I have visited his program probably 5 times in the last 7 years or 8 years. So I actually have seen most of the stuff. I haven't been for over a year now, but I'll do my best. And I've indulged in adding a few slides of my own, and if we have time, a little bit about what I work on in Kansas. And also, I'm going to experiment with you a little bit. I'm always trying to think of new ways to talk about perennial grain research. I've been working at the Land Institute since 1997, so I've kind of been there while some of these trends that you saw were kind of going up, and so it's really gratifying to see this many people at this meeting. But it also means that we sometimes get tired of trying to explain why we're interested in perennial grains, and we need to keep thinking of fresh ways to talk about them. So I'm going to experiment with one of those. And I invested a lot of time in the graphics, as you can see. This is supposed to make us think of yields or economic profit or something. And our annual crops, such as rice, are very high on this mountain. We've come a long ways, and our yields and profits and things like that are very high. And so a couple implications of that are that as we continue to do breeding, it's a lot easier to go down than to go up, because as you go further up, there's just more ways to go down than to go up. And so we worry about a yield plateau. We feel like we need to keep investing more and more in basic science in order to move higher and higher and not to slip back down. The other possible problem is that maybe we're on a peak, we're climbing a peak, and this is all highly metaphorical, but that is vulnerable. And, you know, maybe we chose the wrong peak somehow. But once you're off on that peak, once you've built your house, it's there, and it's almost impossible to move that. So, and of course, I'm alluding to things like soil erosion as the reason why that we might be vulnerable with some of our cropping systems. So going down, as I said, is very difficult for us to do. Well, I guess I didn't say that. It's easy for us to do biologically. It's difficult for us to do as far as getting funding or motivating ourselves to, whether we're breeders or agronomists, I guess I touched it, or farmers. But sometimes, you know, there are some alternatives that have been proposed. Things like no-till maybe is another peak that's, you know, perhaps pretty close to being as high as conventional ag or maybe organic. In both cases, it requires us to go down through a little valley here as we transition to no-till or transition to organic and perhaps even breed varieties for those systems. It's difficult, but it can be done, and then there's this hope that we can climb back up again. But again, some of these systems are perhaps less secure or more vulnerable to long-term future trends that might undermine them than you think. For example, this is an organic tomato production facility, and you can see it's extremely dependent on things like plastic and labor and electricity and things like that. And no-till, of course, has a lot of benefits. It's done a lot of good. It's still somewhat vulnerable to soil erosion events. And, of course, there's the issues of dependence on herbicides. So that's why some of us are considering not just trying to work towards these kinds of systems, but to sort of start at the bottom. And that's what we're doing when we're domesticating a new perennial grain or really shaking up the genome of an existing grain by crossing it with wild perennials. And one good thing is that when you're at the bottom, when your yields are low or your usability of your agronomic system is very low, there's really only one way to go, which is up, and that's the one thing we hang on to when we're comparing our yields with everyone else's. The other thing is, perhaps we can find a way, there's other peaks on this fitness landscape, this yield landscape. Maybe the perennials can find a different way of achieving high yields. And of course, we could have long conversations about how to not get stuck on some of these lower peaks or things like that. But one of the reasons we think there might be these higher peaks out there is that many perennials could, at least in temperate systems, could have much longer growing seasons. So this is last year. The annual sunflower field has just been planted. You can see the seedlings here. This is another perennial oil seed that I'm working with. You can see it's already 5 or 6 feet tall, same date. These photos were taken on the same date. And so we talk about the percent of the plant photosynthate that's going towards seed may be smaller than in this case, but if the whole pie is larger, if it's able to come up earlier and have a longer growing season, then the actual production of seed might be the same or even conceivably higher. And, of course, we know that scientific crop breeding is capable of making radical transformations in plants, as we saw with maize in modern times. All right, so getting back to the advertised topic, perennial rice. The International Rice Research Institute began working on perennial rice in the 1990s because of this sort of situation. This is upland rice. This is in Yunnan province, but probably it's there's a lot more acreage of this in the Philippines and parts of Indonesia and Laos and places like that, where the rice is being grown essentially in a slash and burn kind of system. And you can see that that these mountains are very vulnerable to erosion. So they began trying to develop a perennial rice for upland, a perennial upland rice. And I'm just reminding us that it's because of this sort of thing, worrying about the loss of the ability to keep producing that rice. In the early 2000s, that program was canceled, and one of the students, a graduate student in that program, Dr. Feng Yihu, returned to China, and he brought back some of the germplasm, some of the materials that had been in that ERIE program. And that's where my institute got involved. We found out about this. We knew that he didn't really have funding to maintain that program, and so we began sending him some funding just to keep some of those populations going at this institute. This is what ERIE had done. They had produced, or they had been working with F1s between RD23 and Oryza longistaminata, which is this perennial wild rice. And so this is what the F1 looks like. The F1 itself was very difficult to produce, and it actually was not made by ERIE, but ERIE used this F1 and then the F2s. So this is back in China, that some of these F2 populations being grown in Yunnan. I think this was one of the F1 plants. That F1 plant has been cloned and is immortal and has been taken all over the place. Here is one of the F2 plants that does have a rhizome. So this is very exciting. Not too many of them do, and of the ones that do, many of them do not produce seeds. They're completely sterile. So, and this is Dr. Hu here. This is they began to really increase their the the rate of work there in Yunnan, evaluating thousands of F2 plants and back cross plants and then some lines, inbred lines that they're developing. Some of these lines produce seeds that are, you know, of respectable size. They have mapped, with these populations, they've mapped the genes responsible for rhizome production. This RHZ2 and RHZ3 are two of the main ones that explain the segregation of rhizomes in these F2 populations. They've also done QTL analysis, and as hoped for, many of these traits relating to rhizomes and perenniality map right to the same, to these two major loci. These are traits like rhizome length, rhizome number, and other traits that we would expect. There are a few other places on these chromosomes and some other chromosomes that, so there's obviously some other minor rhizome genes too. They're now in the process of doing fine mapping to really figure out what these RHZ genes are. And as far as I know, we don't actually know what they are yet. But they're getting close. So this is the RHZ3. So in a parallel effort to this mapping kind of work, they're also developing, using classical plant breeding, just lines. And they've been doing this for quite a while, since 2007, growing out these F2 populations, some back cross populations, selecting these very unusual individuals, and then crossing them with each other and inbreeding and developing true breeding lines. What happened after 2009 was, this was all being done on Hainan Island, Sanya. They had a big base there where they could, it's sort of like us having winter nursery plots in Puerto Rico or Hawaii. But because of development, they lost this field space, and so they had to move everything back to Yunnan, which was considered to be a less favorable environment. It's got more of a winter. And some of their plants didn't survive in Yunnan, but others have survived for multiple years. And you can see the ones that do survive are actually becoming clumps as they survive from year to year. The number of tillers increases. And so this is their most promising line so far, is RPR23, perennial rice 23. This is in two different locations in Yunnan province, somewhat larger fields than what we saw before, which were mostly individual plants. And in both of these locations, the rice is regrowing. So these are second season photos of the rice in at least the second or third season. They are regrowing from underground, and you can see these old stems here. It's not just aerial tillering or aerial branching. It's actually regrowth from rhizomes. I'm not quite sure what this adds. I wasn't quite clear why he had this slide in here. I guess just to show some additional regrowth, perhaps in a third or fourth season. So more interesting is looking at the yield in the first growing season. Now these seasons are, you get two harvests per year. So the third growing season, it would be in the second year. These first two would be in the first year. And so they're starting off at over 5,000 kilograms per hectare with this PR23. In the second season, it was a little bit lower. This is the cooler season. And it's obviously, it's not really replicated. It's just one location, one series of experiments. But still, the yields are very respectable. And if any of us in Kansas got yield on our perennial crops of 4,000 kilograms per hectare, we'd be absolutely overjoyed. The mortality rate was about 3.5%. In another location, a little further south, this is further north. they were getting over 7,000 kilograms per hectare in the first season, and down to 6,700 by the third season. So here, because this was a little further north, it was too cool in that second winter season to get much. I'm not quite sure why we don't have data from the fourth or fifth or sixth growing seasons. Perhaps that just hasn't been compiled. But my understanding is those plots are still there and still regrowing. This line has been taken to Africa, and it seems like they're a little disappointed with how it's doing there. We'll get back to this in a minute, because I think this reveals something about the direction this program has gone. There's other lines in the works, other lines that are being bred. And they're also doing work in Laos. So these are pictures of some of the perennial rice plots in Laos. And you can see that the yield in the first year was quite a bit higher than the yield in the second year. So it looks like, I'm not sure what's happening here. My colleague Tim Cruz, who was just there a couple months ago, he couldn't quite remember what the story was, why it was so much less. It's not that they weren't perennial. It's something like cattle got in and ate all the heads or something like that. So that's to the best of our memory what is happening there. But I think these are ongoing, this trying to take perennial rice into other parts of Southeast Asia is ongoing. And interestingly, in Yunnan province, some farmers are also growing perennial rice that came from a completely independent source. A breeder in another province in China had independently been working on some of these, a very similar kind of cross, very similar populations. And some of the farmers are now selling this perennial rice. And so they went and looked at this, and they concluded it was very similar to what Feng Yi's group has been developing. So it's a kind of an independent confirmation of this, of the approach, I guess. They're also trying to sequence the wild relative, Oryza longistemonoda. And this is too small to really see what's going on here, but they're comparing the sequence of longistemonoda with the other rice species to try to get a better understanding of the relatedness between these species. So I'll offer my one interpretation I have of this program, which is that it's extremely important because it shows that it was rather easy to get a perennial rice. It's really surprising to me how quickly they've been able to get lines that look and behave and yield very close to what the annual lines are doing. And it seems in this case it is a matter of two or three major genes. And they've been able to introgress those essentially or just kind of select for lines that really only had those genes in a annual rice background. So it's very exciting and important for that reason. My one concern is that because the approach has led to a perennial rice that's basically perennial because of a couple of rhizome genes stuck into an annual rice, it's a bit like the diagram I showed earlier. It's a bit like trying to climb back up, starting at the bottom of that mountain and climbing back up the same mountain. That the when we talk about perennial grains, we maybe have overstated it a little bit, that just because they're perennial, they're going to do all these other things, sequester carbon and hold the soil. Whereas in fact, maybe that's just the gateway to getting a lot of those traits. And if all you have is the fact that it doesn't die, maybe you've missed some of the other traits. And I say this because I've seen the wild perennial relative of this perennial rice, and it's a completely different animal. It's this huge, robust rice or grass, And you can imagine that growing on steep hillsides and having deep roots and doing a lot of things we think about. The perennial rice that we've come up with is high yielding, but anatomically and in other ways, I think it's very similar to the annual rice. So there you have it, I guess. it's necessary perhaps to be perennial, but it may not be sufficient. And we may need to capture some of those other traits that we really admire in the perennials. How are we doing? A few more minutes? Well, this is just a little bit to show you what I work on. This matches closely with that movie we saw earlier. There are very few options for perennial temperate oil seeds. We've been looking at a couple of candidates that are native to Kansas. Silphium integrifolium, the perennial, in the same family, in the sunflower family, and Maximilian sunflower. And will they be hearing more about that later, the Maximilian? No. Doug's, and Doug's group is working on this in Manitoba. These species have different sets of traits. Some have larger seeds over here, and others have smaller seeds but more per head. Maximilian. This is what, just to show you what it looks like in our fields. This is a breeding plot of Maximilian sunflower in Kansas, just taken a few days ago. This one, this plant has some traits that are appealing. It's the heads are somewhat synchronous, and that's a big problem with a lot of these wild plants that we're trying to domesticate. Is that the heads are the maturity is very asynchronous. This is what they're doing right now back home. Harvesting this for comparisons. We found one reduced branching plant here that basically has a single terminal head, and we've developed a whole population now based on that, from that mutation that we discovered. This is the number of seeds per head or the weight of seeds per head and this sort of seed size of the wild type, and these are a recent population that has this reduced branching trait. And so we have a lot of plants that are terrible. They have, you know, almost no yield or tiny, tiny seeds. But as a whole, the population allows us to find individuals. This trait allows us to find phenotypes that we wouldn't have seen otherwise out in here. And of course, those are the ones we're selecting. As we've gone through recurrent selection, the population, starting with the gray ones, the original population, the average seed size has steadily increased. We're also looking at stiff sunflower, mainly because if it has larger seeds than the Maximilian, and if we could find even one really, really good individual, we could instantly create a clonally propagated cultivar because it produces these little, nice little tubers. And that's one problem with an outcrossing perennial that you're domesticating. It's very difficult to get lines or true breeding varieties other than using asexual methods. And the one that I'm even more interested in and trying to promote here shamelessly is Silphium integrifolium, a native of Kansas. Here is it in the Konza Prairie. The reason is it's got this really strong drought avoidance. This is Maximilian sunflower here. This is the Silphium up here in 2012 when we had a severe drought. And this is probably why the root system is extremely deep. It actually has two root systems, a shallow horizontal root system and a vertical root system. And so we think this species can bring to agriculture a new set of traits beyond just being perennial. So that's what it looks like. And it seems to have a kind of agronomic growth habit. Fairly large seeds for a wild plant, fairly high oil content. So we've just begun to really expand the breeding and domestication work with this species. So I'll stop there.